Welcome to the Organic Gardener Podcast. I'm your host, Jackie Marie Beyer. Let's get growing.
Hi, listeners. I'd like to invite you to visit our website at organicgardenerpodcast.com, where you can sign up for our newsletter, download our ebook on organic gardening basics, and get started on building your very own organic oasis today. Welcome to the Organic Gardener Podcast. Today, I am super excited to introduce my guest because it's another person that I connected with at the Aero Montana Expo. So my guest today is Neva Hassanin. Neva Hassanin. And she not only came to the event, but she brought the environmental studies students who many of you listeners have heard me talk about. One thing, I love the millennials. I think they're the best generation to come along in a long time. And these were some of the best millennials you could meet anywhere. They were just super fun and exciting and interested in things and doing cool things. A lot of them were also in the Food Corps program, which I had never heard of, which is kind of like the Peace Corps, but an AmeriCorps, but based on food. Neva focuses kind of, I'm just going to let you go ahead, tell us about yourself before I say something wrong.
You're fine. Thanks so much, Jackie, for having me on your show. It was great to meet you at the Aero meeting. The Alternative Energy Resources Organization is one of our leading groups in Montana working to promote sustainable agriculture and food systems and communities. So it was really a pleasure to be there this year and enjoy the company of people from across the state who are thinking about how to build a more resilient and sustainable future. My work at the University of Montana in the Environmental Studies program has encompassed a variety of things, including I lead up our emphasis on sustainable food and farming, which we really developed about 12 or 13 years ago, and it's become a very popular aspect of our program.
Okay. Do you want to tell us, so I've told listeners, and maybe it's a little different now because I went to school back in 1988, but I didn't even know what an environmental studies major was or that there was anybody who could. Do you want to start there and tell us a little bit about just the environmental studies program and what somebody who majors in environmental studies would study?
Sure. We have a program at both the undergraduate and the graduate level. And environmental studies basically tries to take an interdisciplinary look at environmental problems. We're basically convinced that environmental problems are not going to be solved by a narrow technical solution, or in very few cases will that happen. Instead, environmental problems, as your listeners probably know, encompass both ecological as well as social, economic, political, the arts and humanities. A whole variety of perspectives need to be brought to bear in order to solve our environmental problems. So we require that our students take courses in the natural and social sciences as well as the humanities. And then they go a little deeper into particular areas that interest them. So for instance, a lot of my students are working on food and agriculture, but they look at it from a whole host of different directions. For instance, some of them are very interested in farming, and they're looking at very practical, hands-on topics. Others are interested in agriculture more generally and how, for instance, farmers are adapting to drought and to climate change. They also end up looking at things at the other end of the food system, right? Where is our food going? For instance, here in Montana, we have a very well-developed farm-to-school program. And I had a student recently who studied the impact of those programs on Montana. So our students pursue a whole range of topics. And we, as professors, see our job as helping students identify their interests and then supporting them in pursuing what they want to do in a variety of ways. So that's kind of the basic philosophy of our program. We incorporate both traditional academics as well as hands-on learning or experiential learning, because we know that especially adults learn best by doing and by reflecting on their experiences. The Environmental Studies program here at the University of Montana has been around since 1970, one of the oldest environmental studies programs in the country at the graduate level. It was founded as a master's program.
Oh, okay.
And the undergraduate program was added in the late 90s. So it is relatively recent, but the program has a long history here in Montana.
Okay. So then was it like, it seems like when I went there, you could get like a EVST, like a minor or something, or an emphasis through the humanities program.
Probably that might have been that was, I believe, before my time, where it was that was sort of the precursor to our regular major. But now you can get a major or a minor or a master's degree. So we have kind of the full options now.
Cool. Okay. So why don't you tell us a little bit about your background? Are you from Montana?
No, I'm not. I grew up in New York State. I did not grow up on a farm or really have anything to do with agriculture while I was growing up, except I did start gardening at a very young age under the mentorship of a dear family friend. But I got really interested in agriculture as a college student. I was fortunate to travel to Kenya. Oh. And this was in the early 1980s. And I was struck when I was there by these vast fields being used to grow export crops, you know, primarily to send coffee and tea and sugar to Europe. At that time, those were the main crops. And, you know, it really struck me that here was the best land growing export crops, and yet there were people hungry. And so I studied how agricultural policy can influence food availability and hunger in a country. And that's really what got me started on this topic. And I also decided at that time that my efforts would be best spent in the United States rather than doing international work. I had been considering that because I felt that I really needed to contribute to change here, because so much of U.S. policy and practices gets exported elsewhere, and we really need to kind of clean up our own act before we admonish others to do differently. So that kind of started my work on this topic. I then, in my 20s, landed a job, sort of fortuitously, working on pesticide issues in Oregon. Oh. And so I have a lot of history in working on pesticide reform, trying to reform the laws that govern pesticide use. And then I also worked for a few years in Montana in the early 90s for the Northern Plains Resource Council before leaving and going to get my PhD. And I moved back to Montana in 2000, mm-hmm. and I have been here ever since, and love it.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Wow. Well, a lot going on there. And so last night we had the movie GMO OMG played in Eureka, and I went to see that. And one of the big things that I really learned in that movie that was kind of neat was they actually had like this little video explaining how the seeds have the, because I've had a hard time wrapping my head around that, how the Roundup resistant seeds, like somehow they grow and something kind of wraps around the plant that keeps them protected so they can spray all the chemicals and the weeds will die and the corn or the soybeans or whatever is resistant will grow. So that probably right. kind of has to do with some of your work that you did in Oregon and the pesticide laws.
Yeah, and I've also done work more recently on genetic engineering. Basically, what that involves is taking a gene from a different organism and inserting it into another species. And so when the easiest way to think about it, we often hear the word transgenetic or transgene. That means they're literally transferring a gene from one species to another species. And these plants and animals or plants and bacteria would not naturally mate, right? They would not naturally reproduce. So that's unlike traditional plant breeding, which is basically selecting particular plants and for particular traits, trying to crossbreed them with other plants that have traits that are desired. Genetic engineering basically, brings in a trait from another species and puts it into the seed of interest. So the Roundup Ready is an herbicide-tolerant gene that's essentially, literally put into existing seed germplasm. So, as you just said, corn, right? They take the seed that's being used for corn in this country mostly, and then they'll put the Roundup Ready trait into it. Mm-hmm. The other major type of, as long as we're talking about it, the other major type of genetic engineering that occurs in agriculture today is creating insecticidal plants. So using the BT toxin, right? Bacillus thuringiensis is a naturally occurring soil bacteria. Organic farmers use it to control things like codling moth. But in the case of genetic engineering, they actually literally put that BT gene into the plant, the seed, mm-hmm. For the crop plant, and then that plant becomes insecticidal, essentially. So in other words, when the boll weevil bites the cotton plant and it will get a dose of BT and its stomach explodes, and so that's how it controls the plant, the pest.
Right. And that was crazy because they were like pointing at fields of corn and saying, that's actually a field of pesticides there. And then the guy was like, well, and then we're eating that. And he was like, basically, it might be going to feed or it might be going to make corn oil or something.
Exactly.
But that they're actually putting the pesticide into the plant. And so, I don't know, just my big concern is, and one big thing that they talked about in the movie too that I really liked was that we don't need to be spraying any of those pesticides, so we don't really need corn that resists Roundup, because if we just weren't spraying the Roundup to begin with, and that there's kind of a fallacy out there that we won't grow enough food to feed the world. But right now we're already growing, they said, enough food to feed 14 billion people, which is twice what we have now, right? We have 7 billion people. So we're already growing enough food to feed all the people. So to say that if we don't use chemicals, we're not going to have enough food to eat is not true.
One of the big
takeaways I took from the movie.
Yeah, I don't know that statistic that you're referring to. I'm not sure that we have that much food to, but we may have enough calories. So one of the things is that, you know, we certainly have enough calories being produced in the world to feed people. Whether those are that's nutritious food is another question.
And then are people getting it anyway? I mean, there's tons of hungry people anyway.
Right,
so
that's the point.
That's the other thing. I'm like, well, what about the transportation piece and the, you know, where are they getting it anyway?
Well, I think the key thing is that hunger and food insecurity are not the result of a lack of food being produced in the world today. They are the result of poverty. Mm-hmm. They're the result of people not making a livable wage. Mm-hmm. And so oftentimes, you know, people have to make a choice. Do I put milk on the table for my kids, or do I keep the heat on? You know, and in Montana, those are really, critical decisions that people have to make. Or do I pay rent? Or do I, you know, feed my kids better food? And so, fortunately, we have in many parts of Montana a good food safety net. Mm-hmm. But in rural areas, perhaps up like in Eureka, I'm not sure, but many rural areas in Montana do not have enough access to food banks or food pantries and the like. And that's something we all need to keep in mind and work to improve.
Yeah. And like where I live in Lincoln County, we have the highest rate of unemployment in the state.
Do you?
Well, next to the reservation, next to Glacier County. But yeah. I think we actually probably do pretty good here. I mean, I don't really know. It seems like there's plenty of options for people to get help with food. The biggest one that concerns me is actually down in Kalispell. So even though their economy supposedly is booming, to me, there's this huge food desert where they just built the high school, and it's near the hospital. It's near huge shopping centers, but there's no actual grocery store on this giant intersection of Highway 93. And there's a big apartment complex there. Then there's on the other corner is the Honda dealership. There's a huge car place. And then there's like Home Depot, Target. So there is Walmart. There is a Naturals grocery store, but I just don't feel like that's a economical solution for a lot of people. And then, you know, the closest place for the high school kids to get food is McDonald's, Starbucks, Applebee's. Those are the three. There's three, and to me, that's even a bigger concern, is that big corner right there. And then as you drive down the highway, you get to the hospital, and still it's another probably a good mile through major traffic. It's a big, before you get the closest store would be Albertsons, I think, is the closest supermarket. And that is a big one to me, how those people eat.
Sure.
And the kids at the high school, especially if they're leaving campus to eat it all, you know, the fact that McDonald's is definitely in walking distance. Whereas to get to Naturals, you just got to cross a major highway. You got to cross Highway 93.
Yeah, I think, you know, these are the kind of access issues that are really important to consider, especially in a place like Montana, where the distance between where people live and the grocery stores can often be quite, far.
Yeah.
And, there's a term called food desert. mm-hmm. which, you know, looks at the distance that people have to travel to get to a major supermarket or a full service supermarket, and, you know, as opposed to a convenience store. Mm-hmm. And, you know, a lot of our rural areas, people are having to travel, you know, an hour or more to get to a decent grocery store. Well, if you're having to make choices about, you know, putting gas in the car, because we often don't have public transportation between, our rural towns and larger towns and cities. If you're having to make a choice between putting gas in the car or having good food on the table and you know, heating your house, all those things, that can present a real challenge to folks. Mm-hmm. So, but fortunately, there are a lot of efforts now to increase access to healthy and nutritious food across Montana, including in the more remote communities. Food Corps, you mentioned earlier, is a program that helps to do just that. It was developed by Chrissy McMullen here in Montana, although now it is a national program, so Montana has a lot to be proud of. Basically, Food Corps is connected to AmeriCorps Vista, and young people mostly, who want to serve and want to help with food-related issues can join Food Corps or apply to join, and then they spend a year working in a community to improve things like the school lunches, helping schools procure or buy local food, helping them set up school gardens, doing nutrition programs in the classroom, these kinds of things, because our young people, as you probably know, have, like much of our population, have a growing rate of obesity. Mm-hmm. Although, fortunately, in recent years, we see childhood obesity in decline.
Oh, good.
It's just the last couple of years, and I think in part that's due to the attention that's been given to it, all the way from the White House down to the lunch ladies. You know, so that's a great sign.
Oh, good. That is a good sign. All right. Well, tell us more about the environmental studies program and like what the students, I don't know, more about like what options they have if they were going to join the environmental studies program. And like, do they have to have a strong science background? Do you have to take a lot of science classes for that?
No. As I mentioned before, we require that our students take some natural science, some social science, and some humanities. Some students choose to go more deeply into one of those areas. For instance, we have a lot of students who are interested in environmental writing, and they're writing books and essays, news articles about various environmental topics. So that's one focus area within our program. The program on sustainable food and farming, the emphasis area, really students are doing a wide variety of things in that. And they've, I think, added a lot here in Montana to this emerging movement, essentially, around local and regional food. So, you know, you can find our alumni working in places like community development corporations or community garden programs or working on policy and advocacy regarding things like genetic engineering or organic policy. So our students end up doing a whole range of different things, And that's just fine with us. We, you know, we want people to pursue their passions and you know, to contribute to making the world a better place. We have a strong emphasis on civic engagement, on people being involved in our democracy. You know, citizenship has sort of become a lost art in the United States, and we need to reclaim that. We need to, I believe, get more and more involved in our government decisions and not leave those decisions up to the so-called experts or so-called professional lobbyists, and instead reclaim our democracy from corporate influence. And so we really emphasize and encourage students to be involved in the issues of the day as they see fit. So, you know, it's not surprising that our students end up in politics, in non-governmental organizations, in governmental agencies, and a whole host of other arenas.
Excellent. I totally agree. And I think, you know, that's one of the things I think, I don't know why every once in a while Skype will just drop a call in the middle of something. Okay. So did you hear what I said about the millennials?
Yeah. Why don't you start? Oh. Say that again.
Oh, so I was just saying that's something like I've been studying a lot of business and entrepreneur. I don't know. I listen to a lot of those podcasts and, a lot of the millennials, I think, really like to incorporate that social responsibility piece and environmental piece into their businesses, the businesses that they're creating and kind of developing an environment like that. And they're interested in that when they look for a place that they're going to work or in their future. Like, it seems like they're much more interconnected. And so I hope that what you said about, you know, civil engagement and people being more interested in not just letting the politicians and saying these people know better, because it's not all that complicated. There's not that many things that people can't, you know, help with. One of the things in that movie last night, so they interviewed Bill McKibben, that he said that I really liked was he was talking about back when our country started, like 58% of the people were farmers, and now it's down to like 2%. But for the first time, I think like in 2013 or 2012, whenever that movie was made, it's finally gone where we have more farmers than we did the year before. Like, after decline, every year it's been declining, less farmers. Finally, for the first time in history, we've turned where there's more gardens and more farmers. And so, and that's, you know, going to be, I think the answer is us taking back growing our own food and supporting local farmers markets, and that the people can feed that, you know, we have food growing in the United States organically. And then certainly at Aero, we met lots of people that are doing it on a larger scale, more farmers like Bob Quinn and the Timeless Seeds people who are growing the lentils, that are growing food organically without having to put those chemicals on there. And it's almost, and it's more cost effective in a lot of ways. Like even Tom Lantman from Canada, who was one of my last interviews, he's interviewed 90 and you're 92, so he was just on, who's been up in Canada, and he worked in the dairy industry for a long time, and he now he's retired, but where he lives he's surrounded by these big chemical farmers, and he talked about how they, even though they own the land, in a lot of ways they're just indebted to either the bank or whoever, you know, they bought their big farming tools from, or the chemical companies who provides them the pesticides, and how in a lot of ways organic is almost cheaper in the long run because you're not having to put out all that, you're not having to borrow all that money. And then the farmers in that movie too were also talking about if you have a crop failure one year, but then they interviewed the guy from the Rodale Institute where they did that farm trial. They have that farm trial, and for 30 years they've been studying it, and over time, in the beginning, they're using the chemicals and things maybe give you a better yield, a bigger yield. And that was something else Tom talked about, Tom Lampman from Canada, is that when you're going for yield instead of quality, you're going to get hurt that way. And that if you kind of focus more on the quality, you're going to produce more in the long run that way.
Does yeah. that make sense? Absolutely. The history of agriculture in this country, you know, includes the fact that we had a very deliberate process starting about 150 years ago when the land grant universities were established. The idea was to increase yield in agriculture so that it would free up people to go do other things. And that's not necessarily a bad thing, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, we got, so, you know, we don't all need to be in agriculture. Mm-hmm. But it was so effective that, you know, basically there are more people in prison in this country today than there are in agriculture. And so it was really effective. It increased yields, and it reduce the number of people, the amount of labor that it requires to grow food today, because a lot of labor has been replaced with technology. Mm-hmm. So, you know, on the one hand, that's a real benefit of modern agriculture. That process accelerated, of course, after the Second World War, and chemicals, synthetic fertilizers and pesticides became much more common in our agricultural system today. And in fact, farmers were in many ways given incentives to adopt those technologies and to maximize their yield through government programs. But, you know, while there's a lot of benefit to that productivity, I think there's a couple of things for us all to recognize that there are alternatives, and people like the farmers at Timeless Seeds or other organic growers, or not even organic, but people who are using lower input practices, you know, can do very well. It takes some time in the transition if you're moving over from chemical to organic or chemical to lower input, because the soil needs to recover and to be built through things like green manures, cover crops, compost, and that kind of thing.
So, you know, I just read an article by Maria Rodale about the transition and how, and she was talking about what kind of government help we can get to help farmers move through that transition. That was a really good article.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so, I mean, basically what we do in this country is we reward and subsidize industrialized production, but not so much alternative strategies, and hopefully that will continue to change. It has changed somewhat over the last couple of decades, even just by getting more research done on the alternatives. Mm-hmm. But one thing I think it's important to remember, Jackie, is that, you know, the farmers who are using conventional techniques, they're not stupid. They know that these chemicals are problematic in many ways. They work with them day in and day out. They know they're expensive. And oftentimes they feel like it's the way they have to farm. Mm-hmm. And it takes some risks and you need support to make transitions. But thankfully, you know, some of that is underway. So I think, you know, I think that the important thing to remember, this isn't about individuals, you know, or people being bad people or anything. It's about systems and policies that need to change to make our farming practices more sustainable. And, you know, there are some of these changes underfoot. And in part, I think those changes you mentioned, the economic influence, I think that has a huge impact. In other words, historically, we have created a system of agriculture in this country that has replaced what used to come from on the farm with inputs that are purchased from off the farm, right? So
yeah,
farms used to provide their own fertility, but with synthetic fertilizers that are fairly cheap, you know, and easy to apply and so on, farmers replaced that farm fertility with something they purchased from off the farm. Well, when prices go up of those fertilizers, as they have, for instance, when the price of oil goes up, because those fertilizers are based on petroleum, natural gas, they, you know, farmers find that their costs go up, but they don't necessarily make more when they go to sell their grain, for instance. Mm-hmm. So many farmers have transitioned. This is my main point here, is many farmers have transitioned because of this economic opportunity to reduce their costs as much as any philosophical kind of commitment. Oftentimes when they start to transition, they see the benefits, right? And they may go deeper and deeper into this. So for instance, someone like Bob Quinn, he did not get into organic agriculture in the 80s out of a philosophical commitment. He got into it out of economic opportunity. But now, of course, he totally believes in it and is probably one of the leading organic farmers in the country. So that's just the kind of thing that, you know, we need to look at a lot of different dimensions there when we think about people making changes to their farming operations.
Mm-hmm. I had another guest from down in New Mexico, Dave Salmon, who talked about that too, that he got into organics after he had a horticultural degree from Colorado. And then when he started his nursery, he got into organics because he wanted to find ways to help his customers and clients be more successful in their landscapes. And that was just the best way to help the people who bought his plants. I'm a total believer in that. I always see the good in people and think that everybody's just doing what they think is the best, and that we all have a common ground, and that we want you know, the most healthy, nutritious food that we can grow in the, you know, the best way that we can grow it.
So right.
I think that we're all going to get there. And the more we talk about different solutions and present them and get the, to me, it's always, you know, back to education, letting people know how to get that information out there and how to help and empower people to make the right choices. And I always feel like also like with our senators and our congresspeople, and especially in Montana where we have access to our senators, mm-hmm. you know, it's much easier for me to reach out to John Tester or Steve Daines or somebody than it is for, like, you know, you grew up in New York too, my mom in New York, to reach out to her senators. But, you know, like John Tester wants people to support, or, you know, when he wants help supporting, you know, the Labeling Act, he can't do it by himself. You know, congressmen, whether they support you or agree with you, they can't do it by themselves. It's the people that make the changes. Really, I guess.
Absolutely.
But I try to teach people a lot.
Yeah. And I think, absolutely. We need to work with Senator Tester. He has been one of the strongest advocates for the public's right to know about the ingredients in our food. He has supported programs to for beginning farmers, for organic agriculture, some of the best pieces in the Farm Bill. He's just really done a terrific job in the agricultural realm, and he is the only working farmer in the Senate. And he happens to be an organic farmer, and so he understands the constraints and opportunities that are involved, we couldn't ask for a stronger senator than Tester on this issue.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, like you said, to have somebody who's actually farming and is and has chosen to be an organic farmer says a lot right there.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, he did that a long time ago, back when organic wasn't cool. I mean, it used to be when people like John Tester or Bob Quinn, right, in Big Sandy, Montana, I mean, when they started going organic, you know, it was hard to hold your head up high in rural company because it was seen as this throwback, you know, this thing that was going to take us back to the dark ages. And yet, you know, many organic farmers in Montana today are doing much better than their conventional neighbors because of the premium they reap in the marketplace for organic products, as well as the reduced cost that they have. So I think today that's totally changed on its head, you know, turned on its head from what it was when people like Senator Tester took risks and went organic decades ago.
Mm-hmm. And it's nice to see that people are doing it on you. I mean, they have big pieces of land, you know, right. Thousands of acres, right, that they're farming. It's not just like a little small quarter acre or 3 acres or, you know, it's not a small plot of land. They're doing it on a large scale.
Right.
So, right. Okay. Well, anything else you want to share with us today, Neva, about the environmental studies program or your students or?
Well, I think, you know, you just to kind of wrap up, I think, you know, you talked earlier about the millennials and, you know, that's the group I work with a lot. And I think that they really are engaged and interested in food issues because they realize that food is central to our lives, you know, as human beings, but also culturally, as well as, you know, it's the way in which we interact with the natural world every day, whether we're thinking about it or not, right?
That's true.
And, you know, whatever we do today, we're going to do because we first ate something that grew from the soil. And so, but the food issues also raise important questions about how we structure our economy, access and inequality. So I think that young people are very interested in these topics because of this interdisciplinary kind of nature of it. Also, they're very excited about growing food, right? Many of them did not grow up on farms, and yet they're wanting to learn about how to grow food. For instance, we have one of our most popular programs in environmental studies is what's called the PEAS Farm. It stands for Program in Ecological Agriculture and Society. And the PEAS Farm grows tens of thousands of pounds of food every year. They're not certified organic, but they basically follow organic practices. And the food goes to community members, either through a community-supported agriculture program. It also goes to the food bank and the homeless shelter here in Missoula. So we're trying to get healthy, nutritious food to be available to anyone who wants it and needs it, not just those who can afford it. And our students, through this program, they not only learn how to grow food, right, but they also learn a lot about community. They learn, you know, about the larger food system issues, as well as the importance of taking some responsibility as citizens, you know, for our neighbors and for being involved and caring about our communities. So I'm encouraged by their enthusiasm, just like you said you are as well. And so I hope that we'll continue to be able to support them in these efforts and have them lead us into a much more sustainable future.
I mean, where is the Pease Farm? Is it on campus?
It's about 2 miles from campus up in the Rattlesnake. It's on almost 10 acres. Wow. And we partner with an organization called Garden City Harvest here in Missoula, and they run the CSA, the Community Supported Agriculture. They also manage a youth harvest program, which involves so-called at-risk youth also working on the farm side by side with our college and graduate students, which has been a awesome, tremendous mentoring experience. And so, you know, you may want to talk with my colleague Josh Slotnick at some point. He's the person who conceived of this idea and started it almost 20 years ago now, in 1997. And it's an important part of our community and a much loved aspect to it.
Okay, yeah, I would love to talk to him. Awesome. Great. All right, well, I think listeners are going to like this and enjoy hearing about all these different things that are going on and different opportunities. And, you know, like I said in the beginning, I had never even knew you could get a degree in environmental studies or what an activist was, an environmental activist or anything, when I first moved to Missoula in the late 80s. And I knew quite a few people that were in what program? I can't remember what it was called, but they got to go on like some big field trip. And
the Wilderness Civilization.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Now, is that through the Environmental Studies program?
No, that's through the College of Forestry and Conservation, but a lot of our students end up participating in it. So it's not housed in our program, but they're strong partners.
Uh-huh. Do you want to tell listeners, do you know anything about it, or?
I better leave that to them. Yeah. I'm not sure how it's operating exactly today. So,
okay. Okay. Well, thank you so much for sharing your knowledge today. And
you bet.
How can listeners reach out to you if they're interested?
Well, you can contact me by going to the website for the Environmental Studies program at the University of Montana, and you should be able to find my contact information through the faculty listing on our page.
Okay, and I'll put the link in the show notes.
Thanks.
Okay. Well, thank you so much.
Thanks so much, Jackie. Take care.
Thank you for listening to the Organic Gardener Podcast. I'd like to encourage you to check out our website, organicgardenerpodcast.com. That's just organicgardenerpodcast.com. And you'll see the links to everything that we've talked about today in the show notes page and all the other episodes there. You can easily search for people by name. You can download our ebook on organic gardening basics and subscribe to our newsletter for updates and just different things that are going on. Thanks for listening, and remember to grow.